McCloskey for this McCloskey Speakers Series. Thank you, Fred Malik, for always being helpful with the Republican governors here. We're a nonpartisan institute, so if you want, Governor Terry McAuliffe is going to be here on August 3rd on this stage at 6 p.m., so you can hear both sides if you want. We also have coming up on August 6th, Condi Rice, Steve Hadley, Susan Rice, and Tom Donilon, which ought to be really interesting given the world we're facing today. So show up for that and many other things. But today we're here for the Republican governors, and we have a lot of repeat visitors and a couple of newbies. On my left is the newbie of Governor Bryant from the great state of Mississippi. And I think you've been here before, Governor Burgum, haven't you, or no?
In the audience.
In the audience. Oh, well, you've been promoted. I know Governor Fallon's been on stage before. And Governor Greitens, I've seen you many times, so I'm not sure you've been on stage. And Scott Walker is a regular. So welcome, everybody. The Senate just voted today. Leader McConnell was able to get the votes to proceed with a health care bill that would have amendments and everything else, which raises the question, and I'll start with you, Governor Walker, what would you put in a health care bill for your state and for the nation?
Well, I think not only for me, but I think most governors, including not just Republican governors, my guess is Terry McAuliffe, which I love. He's a good friend of mine, but it's no wonder. Terry talks long enough. He needs all the rest of us to make up for the amount of time Terry would talk when he's there, so you'll get a long program from him as well. But no, Terry's pretty interesting. I think a lot of Democrat governors would share the same sentiment I'm about to say, and that is just give us a full-scale block grant, not only for money, but for responsibility. Give the resources and the responsibility back to the states. It's what our founders intended. It actually works. Obamacare doesn't work right now. It's failing. Most states in the nation have major rural areas of their states that have one or no providers. A number of the ideas have been kicked around. I think a number of governors are concerned about. But giving just a full-scale block grant is adequate.
Well, wait, so if they gave a block grant to your state, what would you do on pre-existing conditions? How would you square that circle?
We had a successful program before. We actually have, I'm a state that didn't take the expansion. There's a wide diversity of opinion on this on governors. It's why there's 33 of us. We represent many different views in many different states. But we had, in Wisconsin, we're a state that didn't take the expansion, didn't do a state exchange, and yet, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, we don't have an insurance gap. We're one of the top 10 states in terms of insurance coverage. We're one of the top 10 states in terms of access to health care, as well as quality of our health care systems. And we were able to do that by allowing people who were in poverty, meaning 100% or less of the poverty level, so actually in true poverty, to be covered through Medicaid. Those above, we transitioned into the marketplace. And when it comes to things like pre-existing conditions, we took care of things like that before we even had a very successful high-risk pool that many people didn't qualify for under Obamacare that would have in the past, and we'd like to do things like that in the future that allowed premiums to stay at a reasonable or low level. At the same time, we covered people who had not only just pre-existing conditions, but had high risk, and we helped offset that so that it didn't push onto the rest of the marketplace.
And real quickly, would you try to disentangle health care from the employer-based health care system so with this new economy, people can move from job to job more easily, or is it best to keep it employer-based where possible?
I think portability is a key. If people can take things and have an assurance that they've got health care that they can take no matter where they're at, I think that would be a great thing. And it's part of just looking at the way that how you not just change health care, but a part of this, as Walter, as you know, is how the tax structure has been focused. Mm-hmm. The idea that having some of the discussions that others have had, I prefer a block grant, leave those decisions to the states. We're really good at fitting the needs that my needs in Wisconsin are going to be different than those in Colorado, or not just Colorado, but California, New York, you name it. And I think the people in our state know better how to make those decisions. But I would be very interested in portability so that people had the safety and security of knowing where the health care is. In the past, part of the reason they couldn't do that, because the tax code gives the advantage to the employer,
right,
but not to the individual. And so there already is a subsidy, if you will, in terms of employer-based health care, which most Americans either get it through there or, if they're old enough, through Medicare. There's a limited number that don't. And again, I think the states are the better place. We're more effective, we're more efficient, we're more accountable than the federal government.
Governor Greitens, so how would you do it in Missouri?
Look, I realize that talking about your home state too much is probably like making people watch your home movies, right? That kind of act. But I think it's important for people to know that in Missouri, as has been true in Wisconsin and in many other states, you know, people in Missouri have been hurting under Obamacare. We've seen double-digit premium increases year after year. People's deductibles are rising. And, you know, I'd never been involved in politics before I ran for office. I'd run a business. I'd been a Navy SEAL. I'd done humanitarian work. And we did town halls all over the state of Missouri. And people came, and this was hurting people. It was affecting people at a very real and tangible level. And they were looking to us for assistance. And I would say I am in complete agreement with Scott that what we want to have is maximum flexibility.
So what would you do with that flexibility? Sketch out on a whiteboard a great healthcare plan for Missouri.
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot of different options. One of the things that you have to do is look at what's working. I'll give you just one example of one of the things that we would build on in Missouri. So Missouri happens to be one of the world-leading centers for telemedicine. We have a fantastic telemedicine center in St. Louis, Missouri. Mercy Healthcare is doing fantastic work in telemedicine. And if you're not familiar with telemedicine, it allows doctors to serve a lot of patients. When you have rural patients in many counties in Missouri who don't have ready access to a hospital, it allows a physician to interact with someone via an app that looks very much like FaceTime. They can also get at the same time, they can get, you know, using things that are equivalent of a kind of advanced Fitbit, they can get a lot of data about a patient's particular condition. And they're seeing fantastic results in telemedicine. They're lowering the time and the costs that people are spending in intensive care. They are saving lives, but because of a lot of the regulations that are associated with Medicaid as it's currently structured, they're not able to operate in a lot of counties throughout the state of Missouri. So I think one of the things that you want to do is each state's going to have different pockets of success, and you want to build on that success. Missouri is one of the world-leading states in telemedicine, and that's not all of the answer, but part of the answer is figuring out how you build on that success and then enable that so that you remove regulations so that you can use those successful systems to meet the needs of people around the state.
Mm-hmm. And all right, Governor Fallon.
Well, first of all, I'm glad the Senate finally did something.
Yeah, right.
Someone forgot a vote. You know, I had the opportunity to be elected to Congress in 2006 and served till 2011 when I became governor of Oklahoma. So I was in Congress during all the Affordable Health Care Act, the Obama Health Care debate in Washington, D.C., and I was there the morning they rolled out the health care bill, and we said, well, we don't know what's in it. And they said, well, you'll know what's in it after it passes, which we've been finding out for years now. We're on our seventh year. But I can tell you, being on the flip side of being a governor now, not someone in Congress, being on the governor, having to implement, having to work through the Affordable Health Care Act, that it certainly does have many challenges that we've seen. We're one of the states that we have been down to one carrier because we went with a federal exchange. We didn't do a state exchange. We did not expand Medicaid. We didn't have the money to put the 10% match up. And what we have seen in our state is that our premiums with our one carrier, which is Blue Cross and Blue Shield, which is a great company, our premiums went up on the plans they sold 75% this past year. Mm-hmm. That's not including what happened the previous years, that's just this year. And I have teenagers, or not teenagers, 26 and 30 who are, they're older now.
They were.
They're grown up now.
It happens.
But my son rolled off my plan when he was 26.
Right.
And he was, you know, starting out in his career. And so he got on the federal exchange, bought some health insurance. But now his health insurance premiums have gone up a huge amount.
But as we said before, instead of looking back, let's look forward. What would you put in a bill?
So looking forward, we got to find a way where we can make it affordable. I mean, that's the big thing that I see for both employers and both for individuals. Back to what the previous governors have said, the flexibility is very important. Block grants are important. But if we block grant and give us flexibility, they're going to have to untie our hands to let us innovate, create. But if they keep a lot of the rules, regulations, restrictions on what we can and can't do, we won't be able to do some things that we'd like to do. We had a risk pool for the uninsurable, you know, prior to the Affordable Health Care Act, which it made us give that up. We just recently voted on law this session to be able to put that back in if we need to, if the bill goes away.
So you would handle pre-existing conditions of people moving from job to job by a high risk pool? Is that the best way to do
that,
it?
That would certainly help. And of course, we support portability too, to be able to take your insurance from job to job, and keeping your children on your plan at 26, I think has been a big asset to those younger folks starting out their careers.
We could raise it to 36 for people like you and me.
for my 30-year-old, yeah, that'd be right. That'd be right. But it's exciting that we're going to continue with this debate, but our healthcare system is failing. People can't afford it. And you know, you run into a lot of people that say, even though it's mandated, they can't afford to buy it, so they're just not buying it.
Mm-hmm. Governor Burgum, what would you do if you were sitting there either on the Senate floor or in the mansion and said, I now have to write a health care bill?
Well, first of all, Walter, let me just say thanks for hosting, and thanks for everybody that's here at the Aspen Institute. It's wonderful to be with these other governors talking about having civil discourse about ideas, so thank you for that. But let me just, I'm going to come after the premise of your question, because the premise of your question is that you actually could write a bill that in the federal government that would solve the problem. And I don't believe that's possible. And I'll say why, because...
No, but I asked you, what would you do in your state? Yeah. How would you write a bill for your state? Because I'm interested in the different states.
Let me just give you some more thoughts on this. It's, you know, we have about a $17 going to $18 trillion economy. $4 trillion of that is in healthcare. That's larger than the Soviet Union's economy was in 1989 when it collapsed. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to centrally manage a portion of healthcare insurance for that piece. Mm-hmm. Technology is moving this industry faster than anything else, whether it's in, you know, drug therapy, medical technology, medical devices, clinical operations, education, the pharmacy side of things. It's moving way faster than the regulators can even possibly think about it. So the only way that we can solve this thing, so to your question, what we'd have is what these other folks have all said, which is we've got to give not just flexibility to say, we've got to have 50 platforms of innovation. We have to let states try to figure it out and try to bring the free market back. And as far as healthcare IT, you know, 8 years ago, what never comes up in this debate, with the stimulus bill in 2008, there was $30 billion that went towards electronic healthcare records that subsidized them on 80 cents on the dollar. So have any of you ever been to your doctor and they've had their hands on the keyboard and they had their back to you? I mean, has that happened to you? I mean, everybody I talk to, they say, and then I talk to, you know, go around the state, and I've gone around the country because I've only been in this for 6 months. I've been in tech for 30 years, software specifically, and up until last fall, I was a chairman of a board that was a company that was doing software for healthcare. So I'd go to healthcare systems all over the nation. There isn't a one that I can find that's actually the providers are seeing more patients per day now than they did 8 years ago. This industry, healthcare, has consumed almost $1 trillion of IT over the last 8 years, and productivity's gone down. You know, in the history of the U.S., technology always improves productivity, not in healthcare. If we want to actually lower the cost of healthcare, we got to stop calling a thing called a national healthcare debate, which is only about a portion of healthcare insurance for a subset of our people, and actually have a discussion about health and about care and about the productivity of the providers. And what I would put in a bill is the flexibility was you'd push the dollars upstream, because we spend it on sick care, not on prevention, whether it's on addiction treatment versus incarceration. That's what we do. Mm-hmm.
All right, I'll turn it to you, sir.
First thing I would do is get a big whiteboard and get these governors in a room. And in about a 4-hour period, we would have a bill that would be, I think, acceptable to a majority of Americans. Because we would take that 60,000-word bill that now is known as Obamacare, throw it out, start over again, and say we're trying to provide health care for people who need it. Children, aged, the infirm, the widows. You remember that category that were the really needy that we said we've got to make sure that we take care of those people? So we start with that. And the other thing I do is, what's my budget? How much money do I have to spend? Now, in government, when I was in business, I knew how much money I had to spend so I would know what I could do with that. Now what they do is say, here's what we want to do. Let's go find the money. And if we don't have it, we'll borrow it from somewhere, or we'll pretend that we have it. So first off, we find out how much money do I have to spend? And then we would block grant to governors, because you've heard it, every one of us is a different state. Louisiana's a little bit like Mississippi, but only north of I-20.
That's right. New Orleans, we'd
have
our own
bill. So every one of us, prevention is the key. I mean, absolutely. We wait till someone gets really sick and they end up in the emergency room. So we are in Mississippi trying to do all we can with Healthy Mississippi, and starting with our teens to tell people you can take care of yourself. Look, if I could stop people from abusing drugs and alcohol, shooting each other, morbidly obese, do you understand how short then my Medicaid costs would be? But they go out and do these things to themselves, and I found out one thing about government. I can't stop you from doing something you really want to do. I can write laws. I can come and preach about it, and I'm pretty good at doing that. But I've got to encourage you some way. I've got to be able to say, you're going to have a medical savings plan, and we're going to put money in there, and so that's going to help match other medical costs. Or maybe if you need some preventative medicine, you can pay for it out of your savings plan. I once said, as we looked at teen pregnancy in the state of Mississippi, I would go in the state of Mississippi and find every 17-year-old girl to 21 or 22, and if she doesn't get pregnant, I'll buy her a Prius. I know.
I cannot wait for you to get this block grant.
I would save money. We would save money, but what we did was put a group of teens together. We worked with our faith-based organizations, and teen pregnancy is down 22% in the state of Mississippi, 22%. We're leading the nation in telemedicine, so I can get that nurse into that home in Sunflower County with that device and treating that Medicaid patient that needs it so much that doesn't have a car that will get her to the hospital. And so perhaps I can keep her from losing a leg to diabetes. There are things that we can do as governor. And what we then do is borrow those good ideas from other governors. Mm-hmm. So when I see these guys doing something and ladies doing something really good, I just go do that. And you pretend it's your idea. I think the Senate and the House has got to realize this is not a political issue. Yeah, we need to stop politicizing this issue and realize this is a societal issue. This society will depend, the next generation and the generations of the greatest generation, very lives depend on what we do here. Because I've got a huge population that'll be going into extended care homes, and a lot of them are blue collar, and a lot of them are poor, and they're waiting on Medicaid to help pay for that next 15 years, that extended period of their life that someone else will be taking care of them. And if we don't have the money, what do I tell them? You give us a block grant, trust us, elect us. If we don't do the job, next 4 years you can find somebody else that can.
Mm-hmm. Part of the issue with Medicaid, at least as it's being discussed in some of the states, is connected to this rise of this opioid crisis. Mm. I know it's hit Missouri just suddenly and with a hammer. First of all, what is causing it?
So I think there are a lot of different factors that are driving the opioid crisis. I mean, there is a law enforcement component. When you think about the deaths that are coming from opioids, I was in the St. Louis morgue this past week. In the state of Missouri, we lose two people every day to the opioid crisis. We also have two babies that are born every day in the state of Missouri who are addicted to opioids. There is a law enforcement component. While we have an addiction problem throughout the state of Missouri, a lot of the deaths are concentrated in the city of St. Louis, where you also have a gang problem, and you have fentanyl and carfentanil, which is being laced into the heroin, which is leading to a lot of deaths.
And that's a successor drug to some of the prescription drugs.
Yeah. So what happens? Most people who get hooked on heroin actually start with prescription drugs. And one of the great challenges, and a lot of the governors here have also taken action on this. I can talk a little bit about what we've done in Missouri, is that you have to address that initial point of contact when people are getting those prescription drugs. I mean, you know, Walter, when I came back from my last deployment in Iraq, I started an organization to help veterans who were returning. We worked with a lot of veterans who had post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, who'd been injured. What happened all the time, Walter, they'd be hurting, they'd walk into the VA, and they'd walk out with a prescription for drugs. They'd be hurting for 3 or 4 more weeks, they'd walk back into the VA, and they'd walk out with another prescription for drugs. So one of the things that needs to happen is we need to think about the way that we're actually managing pain and the way that doctors and dentists are managing pain on the front line. We also need to take strong action. I'm really proud of the fact last week, many of you might know, Missouri finally joined the other 49 states. We created a prescription drug monitoring program in the state of Missouri. So. We got that done, and that's a critical tool for us to be able to identify the prescribers, the doctors, and the dentists who, you know, in some counties, you might have a couple who are responsible for 70% of the opioid prescriptions. We need to be able to identify that. And the way we set up our prescription drug monitoring program, our Department of Health and Senior Services is going to work with private sector companies, get their data, use their analytical capability, so that oftentimes, literally with one keystroke, you can identify where those prescribers are. And then our Department of Health and Senior Services can talk with doctors. They can refer them to law enforcement if that's the appropriate course of action. They can take away people's licenses. Or if the problem is that you've got a prescriber who just doesn't know about the latest recommendations around pain management, they can provide some corrective education. One thing I think is important to keep in mind when we think about this, though, is that there is, you know, when we talk about an opioid crisis and we talk about all of these statistics, you know, in the state of Missouri, for every 100,000 Missourians, there are 89,000 prescriptions for narcotics. Mm-hmm. When we hear about statistics like that, it can often, you know, we can get removed from the human element here. I had last year, my cousin died of a heroin overdose. When we rolled out our prescription drug monitoring program, when I last week legalized Narcan, which some of you might know is a nasal spray that is basically an opioid antagonist that can save lives, we had with us, Walter, a lot of families who'd lost sons and daughters to this crisis. And I was so impressed by their courage, so impressed by their strength. And one of the things that we also have to do culturally is take away the stigma of addiction. One of the things that, I'll ask Doug to talk about this a little bit too, because he's done some good work as Catherine has on this. But one of the things that we heard from people, from a lot of these parents, was they said, you know what, if my kid had cancer, I would have had people showing up with a casserole every night to help us out. But when my kid was addicted to heroin, people didn't want to deal with it. And this is affecting people, their friends, their neighbors, people who they, you know, the people who they see, who they work with. It's affecting all of us.
But
it's
a modern plague. Does that help you think differently about criminal justice reform when it comes to other drugs? I mean, cocaine, I'm sorry. And I'll let you wife has been doing.
I'll just
too.
Jump in here in the back to what Eric is doing and all the other governors, because everybody in the country is focused on this.
You're listening to a live broadcast from the 2017 McCloskey Speaker Series of the Republican Governors Panel. Our summer pledge drive is underway, and we can only bring you live broadcasts like this with your financial support. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
We just passed a bill that restricts opioid narcotic prescriptions to 3 days. That's smart, because there's some research coming out now that says your brain chemistry can change even after 5 days. I had a daughter that got her wisdom teeth out in high school. She got a 10-day prescription. It's a huge issue that we have to try to address. But on the stigma side, Catherine, the First Lady, is here. She spoke so eloquently today, but one of the things that she's done is talked about her own story, which I'll let her share. But she's really, really trying to address head on the stigma.
Catherine, do you want to stand up and say a word or two? Or? No, okay. Don't blame me. It was your husband who did it. Thank you.
But Catherine, after we got elected, we were getting interviewed, and the reporter asked her why she had chose addiction as her as her platform. And in even though she had friends that didn't know that she'd been in recovery for 15 years from alcohol, she shared with the reporter that she was. And this has led to a huge outpouring in our state and really across the country from people that are responding to her courage to do that, because everybody out here knows someone somebody in their family, a son, a daughter, a niece, a nephew, a parent who's been affected by addiction. And if we don't start talking about it, like addiction is a disease, like we talk about heart disease and cancer and diabetes, then we're going to continue to have this problem. And we're going to have, like we had in North Dakota, where a high school kid died alone in a parking lot of an overdose. We've had people die outside the emergency room. Even though we have a Good Samaritan law, they brought them to the emergency room but only got them to the door, died there. And so everybody's got the stigma, and it's costing lives. And the reproach is not going to be a government answer. It has to be a whole of government approach, because it's the schools, it's the healthcare organizations, it's the doctors, it's the dentists, it's government, it's faith-based organizations. Everybody's got to come together, because there's no simple solution for this.
Governor Fallon?
Yes. We passed a prescription monitoring bill probably about 3 years ago, and it was a very difficult battle to get the doctors, the hospitals all on board, and started with a series of articles in our newspapers talking about individual families that had experienced a loss of a loved one or overdose and what it does to society. We also restricted the days that a doctor can prescribe something that's a very highly addictive opioid in the state of Oklahoma, and then we passed the drugs that you can give if someone's overdosed, that we can do that in Good Samaritan laws, which are very, very important. But the other side of the coin that I've been focusing on as governor is how our prescription drug abuse problems in our nation affect our criminal justice system. And how can we as a nation be smart on crime while keeping beds in our prison systems for people who are dangerous, that are violent, that we're scared of, that might harm our families, our communities, or our businesses, or our state, versus those who have an addiction problem, who are nonviolent, who are low-level offenders, but have some type of addiction issue. And every speech I've ever given about, and I spoke Tuesday in Washington about this issue in a national forum on women incarcerated in prison, I've always asked, has anyone in the audience never known anyone that's had an addiction problem? Whether it's someone from high school, someone you went to college, someone in the community, a relative, a friend that's got a son or a daughter, or maybe a spouse that's addicted. And no one's ever raised their hand that they don't know somebody. Mm-hmm. So it's an issue that affects thousands upon millions of Americans. But in our state, we have the highest rate of incarceration of women in the nation. 2.5 times the national average. And we know that 83% of our women in prison have a nonviolent low-level offense, and 42% of those women in prison have a substance abuse problem. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the history in our nation has been that if you run across someone that's been stuck with marijuana or some type of drug, and you arrested them, you put them in prison. And you may put them in prison for a long period of time, or if maybe they gave somebody marijuana, whatever, mm-hmm. and then you get them for distribution, and then you put them in prison for a long period of time. And so we've really been working on our state and adjusting our criminal justice laws, especially as it relates to substance abuse and addiction, trying to do risk assessments with our mental health and our corrections to see what is the true problem. Are they a criminal, yeah. or are they someone that just has some type of mental health or substance abuse issue, and is there a better way that we can treat them? And we have two very successful programs in our state, one called REMERGE, in which we deal with pregnant women, because you'll find that a lot of women that end up in the correctional facilities are pregnant at some point. And so we put them through this program to where we help them get clean, help them finish their education, because a lot of times they don't have their education. We teach them counseling skills, social mm-hmm. skills, how to integrate back into society, put their children back in the home so the children can trust them, and put the family unit back together. And then we have another very successful program that takes women that have been adjudicated to go into prison, but they can opt out to go into this program called Women in Recovery, mm-hmm. which also does the same types of programs. And so we're really into risk and assessment, finding out what the true problem is. And in one of our programs in our mental health department, with risk and assessment of those who are going in corrections, we have found that we can divert 90% of the low-level offenders from even going into prison in the first place mm-hmm. and staying out of prison.
Yeah. Governor Walker, Governor Fallon just raised a very interesting point, which is that the opioid crisis has caused a lot of governors and other people to rethink the criminal justice problem or criminal justice issue, including the whole war on drugs issue, not just on opioids, but drugs that might affect other segments of the population. Do you think that those are connected, and what's your thinking of how that drives criminal justice reform in your state?
Well, it certainly has a piece of the discussion overall. It varies by state. In our state, there are very few, if any, people who are in for possession. For drug offenses, it's typically they might have a drug offense, but they've robbed a bank with a sawed-off shotgun or did a series of other things. We looked at this years ago when we looked at reforms. There are other reforms we could do, but I think every state's different, and even more so if you look at the federal code, a lot of the mandatory minimums that were put in and things of that nature, if you look at the federal penitentiaries, there's a much higher percentage of people that are locked up for drug-related offenses as opposed to others.
Would you think that they should rethink that?
Sure. I mean, I think that's one of those, just as Mary talked about, Nathan Deal, governor of Georgia, has done a phenomenal job of leading on this in terms of criminal justice reform as well. To the larger question, though, you can't legislate your way out of this. You can't lock people up your way out of this. There's got to be a series of things. Since I've been governor, I've signed, I think it's 28 different pieces of legislation, really largely driven as a hat tip, not to me or our administration, but to one of our state lawmakers, John Nygren's the co-chair of what's called the Joint Finance Committee in Wisconsin, the Budget Writing Committee. And John's got a very personal story that he had the courage to act on. About 10 years ago, his daughter Cassie was getting prescriptions like other young people were in their small town right along the border of Michigan, the Upper Peninsula. They were from Marinette. A doctor across the way in Menominee was prescribing OxyContin off record to her and to a whole bunch of other young people. Eventually, the law cracked down, on which they should, on people like that. But she overdosed twice, didn't die, but thankfully was revived, has been in and out of jail. And as part of this process, John got out in front. His daughter has been brave enough to be a part of the discussions. And we now have 28 different laws that cover the whole spectrum, from prevention to treatment to enforcement to a whole assortment of things, what we call the HOPE agenda, heroin, opioid prevention, and education. And when we say opioid, I really would stress to this crowd and everybody here, that's the technical word, it's prescription drugs. You need to say that, because for your friends, for your neighbors, for your kids, it's prescription drugs. And the truth of the matter is, like everybody else here, we've done a bunch of things. We did our prescription drug monitoring system and worked with our state medical society and our pharmacy society. We saw about a 30% reduction in the number of prescriptions in the first year alone. That's because people woke up. But we all have a part to play in it, not just in government, every one of us here. If you've ever been a patient of your doctor, you have a role to play in this. Because we as patients have to realize that the first minute we have pain, we can't run to our doctor and demand that they give us more painkillers. You think about it, when you go to urgent care, what's the first sign you see in the ER or urgent care facility? It's a sign with the faces on that show the spectrum of pain you're in. Why? Because we have measured success for our medical professionals, both in programs like Medicaid, but even individually, by how much they deal with our pain. Even though the data overwhelmingly shows there are many more viable alternatives than medication for pain. Now, there are some. You got to be careful. When we did just another one of our tours, signing another 11 bills the other day, I stress it's tough to be absolute about this because I'm not telling people not to take their medicine. Mm-hmm. If a doctor is giving you a medicine for legitimate reasons and legitimate doses, it's not like smoking where I can tell you, my kids learned this a long time ago, if you smoke, your chances of dying are much higher. I'm sorry if you're a smoker and I'm telling you that, but the truth is we just can say that. We know that. Statistically, we overwhelmingly know that. That is a clear and consistent message. It's much harder because we don't want to tell people not to take prescription medicine, but we need to make sure that we question it. Good example, one of the moms I met, sadly, years ago, like a lot of the stories you met here, from Hudson, Wisconsin, daughter went in to have all four wisdom teeth pulled, got OxyContin. Mother had no idea. Who would ever dream it if you hadn't talked about this issue before? Her daughter got addicted to it, overdosed, and died from a visit to the dentist for OxyContin. A couple years later, when my son now is 23, one of my two sons, went in for his wisdom teeth to be pulled, all four, we told him, you're not using any of that. We're getting you Advil and plenty of ice and plenty of ice cream, and we were just obsessed with it. But that's what it all takes. And think about how far this has gone. We have the obvious stakeholders, as they all do in our state. We have doctors and public health and pharmacists and law enforcement and education. We have now added to our group of stakeholders realtors. Think now. Now, your face has said what most people say to me when I say that the first time. Realtors, what are you talking about? Realtors in our state are now part of our stakeholders when it comes to fighting prescription drug and heroin abuse, because, as you mentioned, 80% of our heroin addicts didn't start in heroin. They started in prescription drugs. Why? Because when a realtor in our state shows a home, they have to tell the person selling that home that before the open house, they have to take all the prescription drugs out of their house, out of their medicine cabinet, out of their kitchen cabinet. Otherwise, addicts, because this is a medical condition, it is so pervasive, the addiction, that addicts will come to open houses looking to take your prescription drugs. How serious this problem is.
Let me get to Governor Bryant on this. And I want to, if I can, deepen the issue, because we all know people shouldn't prescribe it. But I think, I may be wrong, help me here, that there's something more fundamental and underlying in the past 10 years that has caused this to explode in America. And it isn't simply because, you know, dentists prescribing. What are the underlying causes of this drug, heroin, and opioid problem?
I think it's what Governor Walker talked about, too. We now live in a society where everyone wants to be happy. You don't want anything wrong in your life. You don't want any pain. You don't want your children to go through any pain. You don't want them to suffer in any manner at all. So over the years, we've developed this attitude that there must be a solution for every problem that I have. And sometimes you just have to live with it. And so we have done everything in Mississippi you've just heard. We've been in our drug monitoring program for many years now. We've met with the medical association. Dr. Randy Easterling has been leading that effort. I, as the governor of the state of Mississippi, have authority over the state police, Department of Public Safety, Bureau of Narcotics. I'm a former narcotics agent. I've had to knock on a door at 2 o'clock in the morning and tell a parent that their daughter was not coming home, because she had overdosed on prescription drugs and vodka while at a concert that I was working. So that stays with you. Mm-hmm. But it is that societal idea, I believe, and look, I haven't got the empirical evidence of this, but I think it is the idea that there is a solution somewhere in a bottle for the way I might feel, and I just need to find that. And oh, by the way, I have a doctor that agrees with me. I have no guilt. Mm-hmm.
Let me do one more question, which I'll make a jump ball. You can do it, because I then want to turn it over to the audience. We were talking earlier about cyber and cyber hacks of election. I don't want to look back at, you know, Russia, the collusion, but I just read Massimo Calabrese's cover story in Time that came out yesterday, and it said that in 20 states, there were hackers that got in. Leave aside, you know, Russia, a lot of it. China's now getting into it. The 17-year-old probably in your opponent's, attic is probably get into it. We just went through the security forum here in Aspen. Senator Dan Coats, who's the head of the Department of, is the Director of National Intelligence. General Kelly, who's the head of the Department of Homeland Security, were there with their previous counterparts from the Obama administration. And all of them said, the problem is we have 33,000 election districts in this country, meaning Orleans Parish, voter registrars and all. You know, a quarter of them still use Windows XP, which is just, you might as well just open up everything and say, come hack me. They sucked up in Illinois, in Riverside, California, and everything. And they started, these are the hackers in this last election. And I'm not talking about whether it helped one candidate or the other. But they would change names so that when certain precincts came to the polls, they'd say, you're not registered. This is getting bigger and bigger. This isn't like the old days when maybe a ballot box had to be guarded and maybe somebody was stuffing. This is something that could bring down, you know, our democracy in a way. But the problem is most states are reluctant to let the federal government help, even let the FBI or the Department of Homeland Security help. Is there a way that governors could get together and say, we're going to get really serious about securing from cyber attacks, especially from overseas, our election system. Any thoughts? Governor Fowler.
I'll just use another example. There's an organization called the Council of Governors, in which I'm the co-chair on the Republican side for it. But we meet with Pentagon.
You are listening to a live broadcast from the 2017 McCloskey Speaker Series of the Republican Governors Panel. Our summer pledge drive is underway, and we can only bring you live broadcasts like this with your financial support. Please call 920-9000 or pledge online at aspenpublicradio.org.
We have to make sure that our voting systems are secure, that the public can have confidence that if they vote for someone, that their vote matters or vote counts, and that it will be accurate. And then we as public elected officials have to know that we will not be at risk if we put ourselves on the line to be up for an elected office, and we won't get cheated out of something unfairly because someone's hacked into a system. And so there is a group that does look at cybersecurity with Washington, and so it's the states working with Washington. It's not Washington necessarily telling us exactly what to do, but it's a collaboration, cooperation between the states and the federal government. And I think that's a good model and a good example of things we can do.
Would you all be willing to cede any authority, whether it's to the FBI or to the NSA or to, NSA can't do domestic, or would you rather have, I know it's good to try to work together, but I mean, the next time around, it could be China devastating a Republican Party candidate. I mean, this could cut both ways.
And we just had our national governor's meeting last weekend, and one of the things that Governor McAuliffe, who was the national chairman, did was to pass out a thorough analysis of every single state and cybersecurity and the type of systems and firewalls that we have and whether we're coordinating throughout our states. And he gave that to all of us. So it was a major discussion that we had. But I'm not the type of person that wants to just turn it over to the federal government and say, you guys do it for me. Yeah. You know, I'd rather work with them. And I think I know the people of Oklahoma would rather me do it as a governor.
Mm-hmm. Let me open it up, if I may.
Walter, though, can I just jump in on
Governor
that? I'm
Walker.
Sorry. And I know Doug is an expert in this area, not just elections. Yeah. But so I want to just add one quick thing. And Mary just alluded to this with what Governor McAuliffe brought up. This is a much bigger issue than elections. Don't get me wrong. Elections are definitely important at the local, the state, and the federal level. But this is much greater. Cybersecurity, I mean, we include that, as I'm sure you guys do as well. This is one of the key components of our Homeland Security plan and has been for years. We look at the 16 different categories of cybersecurity, everything from utilities, you name it, down from hospitals, from healthcare, the whole bit. So hacking is, I mean, it's sexy to the media because of all these stories about elections, and I'm not discounting that that's not legitimate to be talking about, but cybersecurity overall, I mean, I think most of us look just even in our own homes thinking about your individual, the identity that you have and what happens in terms of people hacking into that. I don't know that the answer is more federal government. I mean, 2 years ago, the Office of Management and Budget, OMB at the federal government, got hacked in by the Chinese. You've had other federal agencies out there. So I don't know that the federal government's any better than the state or the locals. Mm-hmm. We do need to work together. In our state, when we do cybersecurity and we get groups together, we bring the private sector in, local government, state government, and our partners at the federal level to try and deal with it. It does raise one other red flag. You know, years ago, there was this big push to do voting, voting just all online and do digital. And all these sorts of things raise newfound questions we would never even dreamed of a few years ago to say, do you want that even more accessible to people who might be able to hack information? Yeah. And a lot of questions on voting, but on personal security, on healthcare information, you name it. There are groups in our state. We have daily, we get about 3.8 million emails alone that our staff that works on this intercepts that were malicious attacks on information to the state government alone. Mm-hmm. 3.8 million emails a day we stop. So just think about that when you think about all these other areas. That's not just elections, that's everything.
Right. I'm sorry, there was a hand there. Yes, sir. All right. Stand up. Shout. You'll get a microphone halfway through.
We can hear you.
Thank you very much. I've been in the pharmaceutical business for a long time. I sold my company in 1997, and I just have a very brief question that I would like to ask you. I sit on the board also in Washington on the healthcare side. You've spoken about addiction. There are over 30 states who approved medical marijuana and the merits of medical marijuana. Perhaps you'd like to comment on that.
You're in Colorado. Although I must say, we've had it for how long in Colorado? I've never noted. I mean, maybe it was oddly not.
I'll comment. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, my goodness, ahead.
I'm interrupting Walter.
Go ahead.
Guy writes a book about Einstein, and I'm interrupting him up here.
Einstein never used drugs.
Yeah,
go for it.
Well, all right. I don't think you're ever going to be able to walk into a grocery store in Mississippi and buy marijuana. Everyone I ever arrested for drugs and abuse started smoking marijuana. So people...
Is that true of the opioids as well?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I wouldn't say opioids has probably changed because it's never been so accessible. I mean, drugs, you used to have to go in a back alley and find it somewhere, and now it's more accessible through prescriptions. And the other thing we talked about earlier, we understand prevention. We did criminal justice reform. We called it Right on Crime. And Republicans can do that. We can really do criminal justice reform because we go out and say, look, we've been tough on crime, but we understand there's a better way to do it. So we came a long way on that. But I think the medical marijuana that you see in some of the states are very tightly controlled, and most of them for children. I know that I talked to a mother whose child was having 16 to 18 seizures a day. That's a little hard to say no to.
All right, next question. Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I'll try to... Yeah.
You all represent pretty reliable red states. I'm from California.
Bless your heart.
And I was from Illinois. You got any advice
for... Where are you moving to?
I don't know where I'll move to next. Puerto Rico?
Oh, no.
You got any advice for building a strong foundation in what's now a blue state?
Sure.
So where are you from now?
All right.
Yeah. Well, I used to be in Illinois. I'm your neighbor, Wisconsin. When I was elected in 2010, everything was Democrat. Both houses of the legislature, majority of members in the House of Representatives, both U.S. senators, everything was that, and it flipped. And it flipped because I and the other candidates who ran at that point said, there's an economic and fiscal crisis that we're facing in our state and our nation, and here's our plan. We spent a whole lot of time harping on what our opponents or the previous folks did wrong. We talked about what we were going to do right, how we were going to fix it. We stayed on message. We built an organization. We did it at the grassroots. We used digital for sure, so we used new technology, but we did it the old-fashioned way. We used digital technology to go out and give it to people to go knock on doors and talk to the neighbors about what we were doing and followed through on it. And so even though you mentioned two states that historically have been more Democrat than Republican, I remind you there's 33 Republican governors. Are here with us in Aspen right now, and that, Wisconsin hadn't gone Republican for president since 1984 when I was in high school. I've now won that election three times, and we've helped two others win top of the ticket statewide elections there, but I'm not the most surprising. I mean, Bernie Sanders' home state of Vermont now has a Republican governor. Maryland has a Republican governor. Massachusetts has a Republican governor. Illinois has a Republican governor just most recently. You go down the line, I think part of it's just, I mean, each state is unique and different. California has a completely different format, not just in politics, but in terms of the runoffs and things of that nature. But I don't think there's not a state, at least as governors, where we can't be competitive. We offer good candidates, whether they've been experienced in government or whether, like Eric, who came completely out of the private sector, if they're people with a good plan and a good message and they're willing to take that to the people of their states and their jurisdictions, I think they can prevail.
I'll just echo that, Walter. I mean, people think of Missouri as a red state. Before 2016, the election where I was elected, we had a Democratic governor, Democratic attorney general, Democratic secretary of state, Democrat treasurer, Democrat auditor, right? And Republicans, we won all of the statewide offices. And one of the reasons was, frankly, you know, we went out and we did town halls all over the state of Missouri. And when I was elected, the state of Missouri, we were 48th in economic growth over the course of the past two decades. 42nd in job growth, 43rd in wage growth. People were hurting. And we went out with a very simple message, and we told people that our mission was very clear. We're going to bring more jobs, higher pay, safer streets, and better schools to the people of Missouri. We came with a very concrete plan about what we were going to do. And one of the advantages that we had in Missouri is because we'd had great governors in places like Wisconsin and Indiana and Oklahoma who had advanced their agenda, we could point to the fact that these reforms worked. Right, and I came into office. I signed Right to Work. We got more tort reform done in the state of Missouri than in any other state this year. We got regulatory reform that we're moving on, tax reform. And what's happened is just in these last 6 months, Missouri's moved up 9 states in the states that are in the rankings of the states that are best to do business. And we're attracting companies. We've got steel mills that are coming in, into Southeast Missouri. We've got international companies that are investing in Missouri. We're finally able to compete again. So I think at the end of the day, what we did was we went out and we told a story about what was possible for the people of Missouri. And we were able to point to the fact that these policies get results. And because we were able to do that, people sent us to do that work.
Thank you all for coming out here. You governors are the leader of our states. And we need a whole lot of leadership. We're having media that's dwarfing and all of your voices. When Obama was president, he inherited our country. We had $10 trillion of debt. We now have $20 trillion of debt. That's twice as much. We need so much more leadership with Trump's tax plan. His tax plan is beautiful. It's perfect, really, in my opinion. I'm an economist. And what we need is your leadership to get to our congressmen and to our senators and say question is, what are you guys going to be doing to get the leadership to your congressmen and senators?
Well, I'm going to have a few more people because that was a good comment, but I think, you know, there are other people in the yellow dress to try to make a mic runners really, really difficult. Or yellow. Is that Pixie? No. No, sorry. Stand up.
Hi. I have two questions.
All right.
One, I would like for the governors to address gerrymandering.
Gerrymandering.
Number one.
Yeah.
And on the other issue, prohibition lasted 10 years, and it did nothing. 15 years, maybe. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly. Yeah. But it really didn't do much, yeah, did it? So what about on drugs? Do we need something like prohibition, or do we do the total opposite?
All right, let's start with who wants to do gerrymandering?
I'll take it. I taught American and state and local government for about 6 years. So you remember in the old days, they told us gerrymandering was a bad thing. It was created, it looked like a lizard. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the districts, I think, in New York. If it wasn't New York, it probably should have been.
It was Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, close. They have a Republican governor now, so I was going to leave them out of this. But, and we were taught it's a terrible thing. They cross lines, they go down little alleyways, they pick out voters for a particular purpose of electing someone. Now we think it's okay. I fought redistricting in the state of Mississippi because we had a plan that came over from our democratically led House that made sure that every Democrat got elected. And it had salamanders all over it. And at some point, we've got to stop saying we've got these supermajority districts. Because if I've got an 85% Republican district, and I had one, I don't really care about what the Democrats think. See, if I lose every Democrat vote in that district, I still get elected by 80%. And so we've made these super gerrymandered districts on both the left and the right. And so now we're so polarized that we don't have to go out and say, well, you know, I've got 45% of Democrats in my district, I probably need to hear what they have to say. And we're going to have to look at this from a national level to a state level. And the way it worked in Mississippi is the Senate agreed to the House plan, and the House automatically agreed to the Senate plan without even looking at them. And it was encouraged for years.
So what could you do in Mississippi? Could you
stop
a nonpartisan commission to just... Or is there a way to do districts without it being partisan?
I actually found out that senators could do the right thing. You have to kind of help lead them on occasion. Mm-hmm. But you can do the right thing and have to have the courage to do so. And you have to look at some senators and say, we are just not going to make that district like you want it to look.
Okay. I know you had a second question, but I'm going to get to the audience for more. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. First of all, it's been very encouraging to hear your all's leadership from a lot of people coming from the private district or private sector. That's awesome. I'm from Texas, and Obamacare has been a disaster in the very red state of Texas. I've seen it as a small business owner. I've seen it in the private equity industry. It's just been a nightmare. And my question to you guys is, everyone I know in Texas, whether they're a moderate Republican, liberal Republican, moderate, or just don't care, or conservative Republican, everyone wants Obamacare gone. Every single one of them do. And now we've given Republicans everything, the Senate, the House, the White House. And I'm dumbfounded that we haven't repealed this thing. So I'm as a favor, could you guys in your states make sure your Republican senators and your Democratic senators know we want this thing gone? And then my question is, what do you think the chances are that something gets repealed out of the Senate? Just yes or no, does something happen out of the Senate that's a repeal, even if it's not a full repeal?
Scott, you're the national expert here. How's your friend Mr. Ryan and McConnell going to do? They going to get it out by the end of the fall?
Oh, I think they'll get something done this year, just not necessarily this week. And I go back to what we said before. I mean, I think the easiest, best approach is to instead of twist and turn with all these different options, is give it back, give full responsibility and resources back to the states. It's part of it. You heard before people talk about prevention, portability, and block grants. I just mentioned the block grants, but particularly in the prevention and portability, you think about most of us, if we look at our cell phones, as Americans, we know more about our cell plan coverage than we know about our health care. I mean, we got to get back to a point where we have some skin in the game. Part of the portability advantage is if you know how something you own and you track and you're monitoring, you're going to pay more attention to what your cholesterol level is and what your diabetes is like and what your health care is like. But most people don't think they pay much of anything, maybe $10 copay to go to the doctor or whatever the copay is for prescription drugs. We need to be more engaged and have more skin in the game. So I think that's one of the best pushes we could have. Give it back to the states. We're more apt to do that. We're more capable of doing that, and I think that would be the best message. One other addendum. I actually do think he asked a question over there, and I'll answer that to you as well, and that is the you'll see from this panel and a bunch of our colleagues, we've cut taxes. In my state, by the time my budget is done that I'm currently on, over 8 years, I will have cut taxes by over $8 billion in the medium-sized state of Wisconsin, 5.7 million. Income and property taxes will be less. We wiped out an entire state tax when it comes to state property tax. We went from a state that was in the bottom 10 for business to the top 10 for business. We still have schools that are in the top 10 in the nation for graduation rates and ACT scores. We're in the top 10 for healthcare access. We did it while cutting taxes. You know what happened? Revenues actually went up, just like it did under the Laffer curve under Ronald Reagan. The best thing the U.S. Congress and President could do to get the economy going again, which would help us in the states, is to cut rates for corporations as employers, cut rates for individuals, see that money come back where you can invest it back in the American people to get things done. That's the best way to get the economy going.
Governor Bryan. And on education, if you want.
I thought I'd just tell Walter, we haven't talked about public education, which is one of my favorite things to talk about in Mississippi, because when I came into office, about 52% of the third graders were actually passing their third grade assessment test. 52%. But we were socially promoting them to the fourth grade because they had a luncheon schedule that they had to keep. Seriously, that's what they would tell you. You got to understand. So we put in a literacy program. We put a lot of reading coaches. We put more money into the schools, $100 million teacher pay raise. 6 years later, this pass assessment, 92% of the third graders pass their assessment. Now, we started with Jim Barksdale and the MEC, the Chamber of Commerce, starting with building blocks and preschool. We're going back into those daycare centers. We've got to have a learning component. We have an agreement now with our community colleges. They are teaching those daycare workers. So you don't have to teach algebra, but some language, some colors, some alphabet. Teach those skills like how do you problem solve? How do you control your temper? Things that our grandparents taught us when we were staying at home with them and our mothers. And so those soft skills that employers are looking for now are critically important. We're going to get those in the daycare system. About 95% of our children are in daycare. That's the great new frontier for improving education in America, is have a quality daycare center, and it's going to start right here in Mississippi.
I know you gave Jim Barksdale a shout out, but that Reading Institute and what you've done in Mississippi is impressive. I know there are lots of questions out there, and it's now after six, and I've been given a hard stop. So let me thank all of the governors. I hope they'll stick around. Those of you who have questions, come up and ask informally. Thank you for being here, sir.
This is Aspen Public Radio, and you've been listening to a live broadcast from the McCloskey Speaker Series in partnership with the Aspen Security Forum. You can also find this discussion in full later tonight on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Support for McCloskey Speaker Series broadcasts on Aspen Public Radio is provided by Penny Evans Carruth with Aspen Snowmass Sotheby's, opening doors for buyers and sellers in the Roaring Fork Valley. Learn more at penny.carruth@sir.com. Our summer membership drive is in full swing, and live broadcasts like this one from the McCloskey Speaker Series are only possible with support from you, our listeners. Please call in your pledge now so we can continue to bring you these types of live events, 920-9000, or go online to aspenpublicradio.org to pledge your support. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. Your news, your music, your station.